Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of West Obsessed, where the writers and editors of High Country News discuss issues crucial to the health of the American West. West Obsessed is a collaboration between High Country News and KVNF Community Radio in Paonia, Colorado. In today's episode, we're talking about climate change. Usually, we talk about climate change's negative effects and the science behind it. Today, we're going to talk about something a bit more hopeful, what people are doing to prevent it and to mitigate its effects. I'm Kate Schimmel. I'm the Deputy Editor Digital of High Country News, and I'm here to discuss this issue with Editor-in-Chief Brian Calvert, who recently put together an issue looking for solutions to climate change across the American West. I've also got Associate Editor Maya Kapoor from Tucson here via Skype. Thanks for joining me, Maya.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks for joining me here in the studio, Brian.
Didn't have a choice. I mean, great to be here.
Welcome to the show where we bring the writers and editors by force into the studio to discuss what I feel like talking about. Brian, if you could tell me a little bit about why you wanted to do this issue, I think I'd love to know what prompted it.
Sure. You know, in a way, we talk about climate change a lot in the American West. It has very real effects on most of the things that people care about who live in the American West. And so sort of watching this summer of horrific wildfires, we've just been through and are still going through a series of hurricanes coming out of the Atlantic. There are a lot of drought implications impact on biodiversity. All of the things that we sort of care about in the West are, you know, we're just leaking into our coverage almost every issue. And unfortunately, we have a presidential administration right now that has scrubbed climate change from its websites and from its thinking, from its policies. President Trump has said that he thinks climate change is a hoax. And he has not really done anything to prove that he was kidding. I wanted to put together, every year we put together a big ideas issue, and I thought that maybe this big ideas issue ought to be dedicated to the question, just for argument's sake, what if climate change isn't a hoax? And if that's the case, where in the West are people or organizations dealing with the realities of climate change on the ground? Because, yeah, sometimes people think of climate change as abstract. Or not human caused, or a fluctuation of some kind. And there are actually people on the ground who have to deal with climate change. And when I say climate change, I'm really kind of shorthanding for saying, you know, an impact on the global climate caused by human-produced global greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide and methane. And so where are people dealing with those? And we just kind of fanned out across the West to see what the implications were of what I think is a reality. And so I politely disagree with our president on that.
Yeah, and the title of this issue was No Hoax, so it was pretty direct. I have to say, I think one of the things that struck me as very interesting about this collection of stories is I think it is so hard to feel hopeful that anything can be done about climate change, let alone its effects on the region and on the world. And I know that you've grappled a lot with that in your reporting, Maya. What is it like to report on such a huge and often overwhelming issue day in, day out?
Well, I think for me, it would be really hard not to write about climate change because I cover biology and ecology and natural resources in the West, and you can't really write about living systems without writing about climate change. But what makes it engaging and keeps me wanting to keep doing it is that the people I encounter are so passionate about their work and just interesting as characters. So although the subject matter can get really overwhelming, the narratives are always really exciting.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story that you ended up writing. How did you find it?
I actually found it in a really roundabout way. I was emailing with a former supervisor, somebody I worked for at the University of Arizona, who is a climate researcher, who had collaborated with somebody who works on ocean acidification. And I was kind of asking him for suggestions for ways to write about, you know, kind of upcoming topics in climate change. And he suggested I reach out to her. And that was what got me started. But I've been wanting to write more about the ocean in general and and coastal communities in general, because I think it's really easy to forget that the ocean and the land are not separate, and the West Coast really matters for the West.
Yeah, so we sent Maya to look into the effects of global greenhouse gas emissions on the ocean, which is absorbing these chemicals, especially CO2, and changing its pH balance, its acidity. And that's been happening, and we're just starting to understand it. And so it's having real economic impacts on people in the Pacific Northwest who rely on shellfish and other seafood. We wanted to see how it's really impacting communities, which are a part of our, you know, broader ecology. So we sent Maya to look into this issue in the Pacific Northwest along the coast.
Maya, what was your reporting like? Where did you go, and how did you get there?
So my reporting trip was really quick, and it was logistically kind of interesting. It was kind of funny. I was really lucky because I was invited by some researchers at the University of Washington to join them on a research trip. But they do these multi-day cruises in Puget Sound on a research vessel. And they only had space for me one day because the vessel only can bunk six people. And there's so many people who want to collect data on these trips that they didn't have bunk space for me. They could only carry me along as a day passenger one day. And so I had to get to a kind of hard to access pickup point and then get dropped off at the end of the day at another kind of remote location. And so I flew into Seattle and then rented a car and like drove the next day. But the place that I was meeting the ship at like dawn is this, you know, you don't think of like the Seattle area as having remote locations, but it actually was kind of hard to get to. And then I took this all day boat cruise like through Puget Sound. And then when I got, like, I wasn't sure I was going to go on the research trip because I didn't know how I was going to get back to my car or how I was going to get back to Seattle. And there was like no bus line to do it. There was no public transportation, or like really I couldn't do Uber or anything like that or Lyft because I was in the middle of nowhere. There were no hotels where I was going to get off the ship in the evening, except for we were docking at the dock of like a luxury resort that intentionally is really hard to get to. You can get there by like charter planes that can land in the water. And I wish that we had the budget for me to stay there, but I ended up finding a local. Well, it was interesting because one of the researchers at the University of Washington, Jan Newton, was so helpful, like trying so hard to get me on the ship and kept emailing with me about it. But eventually I found a local cab driver who picked me up and drove me at the end of the day, almost 2 hours back to my car, my rental car.
So
that was kind of an interesting circus.
So you went on this like long epic where you ended up spending just a little while with these researchers. I wanted to get back to what exactly they were looking at. Can you tell us a little bit about the life cycle of the animals that they're looking at? What they were looking at are these tiny little creatures that are being really heavily affected by these changes in the climate and in the ocean. Can you tell us a little bit about the life cycle of the shellfish at the center of this story?
the researchers are interesting because they're looking at small planktonic organisms, which you can't see without a microscope, but there are also researchers who are looking at water chemistry. So it's two kinds of research combined. It's people interested in chemistry and people interested in biology working together. But the organisms that I point out in the story are pteropods, which like kind of sounds like a dinosaur, but it's actually a little tiny shelled organism. It looks like it's a snail, basically, a little teeny tiny spiral snail that floats in the water. And people call them sea butterflies because they have body parts that come out of the front of their opening that kind of look like wings. They're really kind of pretty little fragile looking animals. And they are pretty much throughout the ocean. And there's a researcher I didn't get to meet who realized that they might be a really easy way to measure ocean acidification because they are pretty ubiquitous and they're really sensitive to ocean acidification. So ocean acidification is the ocean becoming more acidified over time. And it doesn't mean the ocean's becoming acid. It just means it's becoming less basic. So anyways, these little pteropods, as the ocean becomes more acidified, they are kind of the canaries in the coal mine because their shells are so sensitive that they start to corrode. And so scientists on this cruise, one of the many different kinds of things that they're collecting are pteropods, and they look at them through their microscopes and they see how corroded their shells are. And that is a quick measure of the level of acidification in the water that they're sampling.
Yeah, and let me say that I'm not exactly a scientist or science nerd at all.
So what drew you to this story?
Well, what I think we're sort of jumped ahead on a little bit is that, you know, we're seeing the impact on a whole economy of shellfish farmers who produce oysters and other delicacies for restaurants. So these are people that really rely on a stable system in the ocean to have a livelihood. And so what I thought was really interesting was that you have this really bizarre cause and effect thing happening at a very, very subtle level to us, but to the creatures that live in the ocean, it's wreaking this really slow havoc across these ecosystems. So without knowing anything about that, learning what the implications are, and this is a big system. The ocean is a big, big system. And when it's connected to the atmosphere, it's just chemistry. There's a chemical process happening that is not Republican or Democratic or anything, or even good or bad per se. It's just change. And some of the implications of that change mean that these shellfish farmers have had to adapt. And so that's what we really kind of wanted to find, places in the West where people were dealing with the reality of climate change, but in a way that, you know, their livelihoods are at stake. So that was another part of the process, was understanding the, sort of this economic system that interplays with this really sophisticated scientific system.
So you basically have an ocean where it's becoming increasingly acidic, and that's affecting the shells of all of these creatures, from pteropods to oysters. And where we're seeing that on the coastline is in the economic effects of these farmers. They're not bringing in the crops that they used to. And so tell me a little bit about what these farmers are seeing happen to their crop of shellfish.
Sure. So the population, so to explain how the farms work, the shellfish farms, the farmers grow shellfish from seed, essentially. They call them seed, but they spawn shellfish. They have adult shellfish that they spawn. And it's oysters, mussels, gooey ducks, a whole variety of shellfish. And they grow the babies in tanks that are indoors, generally. And they're bringing the water in from the sound. And so it's, you know, I want to say wild caught water, but I know that's not the right phrase. But it's a water that's coming from the ocean. It's not any special kind of water, and they're feeding them algae mixes that they make. And then when the shellfish get to a certain size, then they're put out, like they're kind of planted out in flats. The water is, it's cleaned and it's filtered before it's given to the shellfish, but the water chemistry doesn't really change. And so what the shellfish farmers have found is that by working with regional scientists, they've been able to mitigate somewhat the effects of ocean acidification by adding sodium carbonate.
What exactly are some of the effects of ocean acidification on the shellfish that they're growing? What are they seeing?
What happens to the shellfish is, as within just a couple hours of hatching from eggs, they need to start building their shells. And they have a little bit of stored energy, but they really quickly need to be able to pull energy, calories from their and just build themselves using resources in the water. And what happens is, as the water acidifies, for a variety of reasons that involve the water chemistry, calcium becomes less available to them. And so the organisms that are most affected are organisms that need calcium to build their shells. And so they basically run out of energy trying to make their shells and don't end up building organs and starve to death. Like they don't build their important body parts because they're struggling so much to build their calcium-based shells and just don't survive. And the farmers have been able to add sodium carbonate to the water that's coming into their tanks, and it helps. They're producing 50 to 70% of the shellfish they used to produce, which is better than none, but it's less than it used to be.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to West Obsessed, a collaboration between High Country News and KVNF, where we discuss issues critical to the American West. I'm Kate Schimmel. I'm here with Brian Calvert and Maya Kapoor to talk about what can be done about climate change, what people are trying to do about its effects, and about the very specific effects ocean acidification is having on shellfish farmers in the Pacific Northwest.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting in Maya's reporting also was so here you have a very specific solution to a problem. And yes, don't panic, Seattle, you're still going to have oysters. But P.S., the ocean is still acidifying, it's still absorbing carbon dioxide. So the entire system might collapse. No big deal. But at least we have baking soda to put in the tanks. Right, Maya?
Well, to a point. I mean, right
I know. This is
now,
our back and forth in editing.
right now, the amount of acidification in the ocean is such that larval oysters and larval shellfish are struggling. As that increases, it will affect adult oysters and shellfish and other shellfish as well. And as Brian knows, so the reason this is affecting the Pacific Northwest specifically is because that's an upwelling region. There's like five or six of them in the world. That's where really, really nutrient-rich cold water comes up from the bottom of the ocean, and that's why you have such a rich sea life there on the coast. But coming up with that water is like all that carbon dioxide that sank down into the ocean from the atmosphere, and it's probably 40 or 50 years old. So that acidified ocean water is reflecting the carbon dioxide we released into the atmosphere 40 or 50 years ago. So something my sources were telling me was even if we stopped all of our human-produced carbon dioxide tomorrow, the ocean would continue to acidify more and more in these regions of upwelling for another 40 to 50 years.
So, just to play devil's advocate though, don't you think it's possible that all of these scientists and all of these fishermen put on a big, huge show for you so that you would come back and tell us some big hoaxy fabrication to further some sort of obscure liberal agenda?
Well, I mean, there is evidence, luckily, for me to point to, so I don't have to just say he said, she said. It's really hard, as one of my sources pointed out, Terry Klinger, who co-directs the Washington Ocean Acidification Center, which is run by the University of Washington, pointed out to me that it's really hard to study like multiple species and systems all happening at the same time in the wild, but underwater volcanoes act a lot like acidification and upwelling, because they release lots of carbon dioxide. They release acidified water. They create acidified water around themselves. And so you can go to areas where these seeps are near underwater volcanoes and see the life that's living there and use that to predict what's going to happen in the ocean in areas of upwelling, where they're soon going to have the same levels of acidified water as there is near these underwater volcanoes. And based on data like that, scientists have made some pretty interesting predictions about what's happening in areas of upwelling.
In other words, everything's going to be fine.
But, okay, so one area of interesting, a positive area that I learned about in all this reporting was, I talked to a couple of staff members with the Nature Conservancy who focus on the ocean, Skyly McAfee and Sarah Newton, and they talked about working with shellfish farmers in the Pacific Northwest and also conservation managers. And they pointed out, ocean acidification is a global problem with global sources, but there are regional things you can do to like buy time to try to lessen the impacts while we figure out what to do about greenhouse gas emissions globally.
And in this case, what you're talking about is basically is protecting these young shellfish while they grow. What else is happening in that regional level?
So it's things like reducing runoff into the ocean from farms and from cities, because that waste, that nitrogenous waste coming into the ocean, leads to processes that are like ocean acidification. They lead to hypoxia, which is when there's all this fertilizer, whether it's human-produced fertilizer from stormwater runoff or agriculturally produced fertilizer. Algae and a bunch of different things grow in the water, and that takes away all the oxygen, and it can really stress organisms in a way that's similar to ocean acidification. And then when the water is becoming more acidified, it makes the effects even stronger. So cutting down on those stressors, or another thing that people are studying is, well, what is ocean acidification related to? It's an increase in carbon dioxide. Well, what takes up carbon dioxide? Plants do. So what about if we try growing more plants in the water, like seagrass or kelp? Can that locally help with ocean acidification? So that's something else people are trying. People are also trying to develop more marine protected areas in coastal systems, because maybe shellfish and now even juvenile fish are being affected by ocean acidification. So why not help them when they're young by giving them safe places to live so they can get as strong as possible while they're growing? So there are regional things that can be done that aren't going to solve ocean acidification, but that can hopefully buy time for these systems while we as a planet try to work on the larger problem of greenhouse gas emissions.
And we have just a couple minutes, and I have one last question for you, Brian. Where are you finding hope when you look across the West at these issues? What moved you in editing this issue?
Well, I mean, I think we can all identify with the stressed organisms of the planet right now. It's a pretty stressful time. I think in editing a package of stories like these, you can see that all across the West, and then we have a lot of stories in the issue from Alaska to Wyoming and Utah and the Pacific Northwest. I just think that people are out there doing their best to understand these things, and that, you know, hopefully some of that knowledge will break through some of the filters that we live in today, and help a lot of people sort of just get on board with finding, I think, national level policy support for these things. So you can try to solve problems at a local and regional level, and individuals can do a lot. But this is really a huge problem for humanity that needs to be solved at a global scale. So if we can avoid nuclear war with North Korea for the next few years and sort of maybe get our priorities in line, I think some people will come around and we'll have policies that'll help us move in a more positive direction.
Well, thank you both for joining me and walking me through this extremely complicated issue, but also for finding a moment of hope there. Brian, I know it's out of character, so thanks for that. And thank you for joining us, Maya. I'm Kate Schimmel, and you've been listening to West Obsessed.